Is it Ms. Roback? Good morning to you and Mr. Kobe. Good morning to you, Council. I assume you probably heard my comments earlier, but I will make them to you again. When you are not presenting to the court, please wear your mask if at all possible. And when you are presenting to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Do either council have any questions before we begin? Very good. Ms. Roback, you may approach and you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Erin Roback. I'm the attorney for the appellant in this case, John Haida, the personal representative of the estate of Phyllis Mendick. And I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, please. Because there are multiple beneficiaries relevant to this appeal that have the same last name, for purposes of clarity, I'm going to refer to Phyllis Mendick as Phyllis and Paul Mendick and his 8 children, who are the appellees, collectively as the Paul Mendick family. This appeal stems from the Paul Mendick family's refusal to honor the settlement agreement that they entered into prior to Phyllis's passing. There are 3 key points that I'd like to discuss with the court today. The first of those is Phyllis's rights under the trust that was established by Phyllis's late husband, Richard, for her benefit, and how the rights under that trust are distinguishable from this court's recent decisions that I believe were decided by the court right around or right after the time that we had briefed this appeal in the McGregor case and also in the Zuterin decisions. The second issue I'd like to talk with the court about today is that continuation of this trust was not necessary to achieve a material purpose of the trust. And finally, that the agreement that was reached between the trust beneficiaries and the trustee, which contained all material terms, remained enforceable following Phyllis's death. Each of these points requires a de novo review by this court. Under Richard's trust, following his death, Phyllis was the sole lifetime beneficiary. Under Article 7 of that trust agreement, upon Richard's death, there was to be 2 trusts that were created. The first was a marital trust, and the second was a family trust. Under the marital trust, Phyllis Mendick had the absolute power to withdraw or to appoint the entire marital trust share. Within that provision, it states specifically that the trustee shall pay all of the principal as the settlor's wife may specify in an instrument or instruments in writing delivered to the trustee in her lifetime. Under the family trust, it was also stated specifically that this trust was primarily for Phyllis's benefit. Under that provision of the trust, Phyllis was to receive the income and principal distributions, taking into consideration other income and principal payments she was receiving under the trust, but not with the express or discretionary authority as to other means that were available to Phyllis. It's also worth noting that that trust also provided Phyllis the power to remove the trustee. Now, at the time that the settlement agreement was entered into, Nancy Jo Haida
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman.
Yes.
Were the 2 trusts, in fact, created following his death?
They were not. Two trusts were not created, and that was one of the reasons why the settlement agreement was ultimately entered into, because there was a dispute amongst the trustee and the beneficiaries as to should that trust have been funded and why it wasn't funded.
Well, it would also implicate what was the material objective of the trust or trust, would it not?
It was, and that is why it's our position and was a position of Ms. Haida acting as Phyllis's power of attorney that that trust should have been funded, and that the material purpose of this trust all along was to provide for Phyllis. And because the trustee of the trust had not funded that marital trust, the trust was not achieving the material purpose of the trust. It was not providing for Phyllis under the provisions of the trust.
Well, what, in your view then, what trust are we discussing?
Well, the court to enforce the agreement The agreement is enforceable under contract law. There was an enforceable settlement agreement reached. When the court is presented with a motion to enforce, the only basis for the court not to enforce the agreement would to be to make a determination under the Uniform Trust Code that this agreement is not enforceable. And if you look at Nebraska Revised Statute 30-3837, subsection B, the standard is whether the trust should not have been terminated and the assets distributed as agreed to by the beneficiaries because continuation of the trust was necessary to achieve a material purpose.
So if I may, then, if this court, I beg your pardon, if this court were to determine that there was no agreement reached, what would your argument be?
If there was no agreement reached, then there would be nothing for the court to enforce. There needs to be an enforceable agreement.
And I'm sorry, did the lower court find there was no agreement?
The lower court never reading Judge Harmon's opinion, it's a little bit difficult to dissect, but ultimately, I don't believe that Judge Harmon reached the ultimate decision here. He never reached the issue of whether there was an enforceable agreement here because he decided the case on the fact that court approval had not been sought prior to Phyllis's death. So he never reached that ultimate issue, which we think is error because the contract under contract law and under the cases that are well established.
We don't have a written contract, do we?
Well, we have a contract between emails between counsel that if you look at the strategic staff case, the Beatty case that was decided before the Court of Appeals, the emails between counsel who have authority to represent their clients can enter into an enforceable settlement agreement. So that's what happened here. There were emails exchanged between counsel agreeing to how the trust assets should be distributed and agreeing to terminate the trust. Under contract law, that agreement isn't enforceable.
However, under trust law, doesn't the court have an independent duty to approve of an agreement which could modify or terminate a trust?
That is correct. The agreement that was reached here was still subject to court approval. So that is correct. And that's why the court still needs to make a determination on that issue. And that issue is whether continuation was necessary to achieve a material purpose. So first we have to decide, was there an enforceable contract? And it's our position there was. And then secondly, is that enforceable? And the fact that the remaining beneficiaries subsequent to entering into the contract now want to back out of the contract, that's not a basis for the court to not enforce the contract.
But you agree that the county court in this case has never approved the agreement that you think took place. Is that correct?
I'm sorry. I didn't catch the first part of your question.
You agree that the county court in this case never approved the agreement that you think took place. Is that correct?
That is correct. And that is error. And we've assigned that as error.
So, and do you want us to send it back to the county court and say you have to approve this agreement?
I don't think that is necessary. I think this court has the authority under its de novo review to make a determination as to whether that contract that was entered into through counsel is enforceable, and then also whether the contract is enforceable under the Uniform Trust Code. And that's whether continuation is necessary to achieve a material purpose. The court has the authority to do that. The other option would be to say, yes, there was an enforceable agreement, but you could still send it back to determination on the material purpose issue. But I don't think that that's necessary. I think that this appeal can be resolved by this court.
I beg your pardon, in determining the material purpose, should the court take into account those facts that exist at the time it's asked for a ruling, assuming there was an agreement and so forth? Should it take into account at the time it's ruling that now Phyllis is deceased and Rosemary's deceased, and how would that impact the material purpose?
Right, I think correct timing to look at whether it is enforceable under the Uniform Trust Code is at the time the agreement was entered into, because that's when the agreement was binding and the circumstances that happen after don't affect the agreement.
How is it binding before court approval under our statutory scheme?
It is binding because it's an enforceable contract under contract law. The question is then whether it's enforceable. I think though under either analysis, whether you're looking at it at the time it was entered into or at the time that the court is presented with the motion to approve, it doesn't change the result here. Under either scenario, continuation of this trust, which was for the benefit of Phyllis, is not necessary to achieve a material purpose. The material purpose was to provide for Phyllis. Because of the mismanagement by the trustee, that material purpose was never fulfilled. And in fact, this settlement agreement that is enforceable actually achieves the material purpose of this trust. After Phyllis's death, what would happen is the trust would still be distributed out to the beneficiaries. But we now have a contract that says how that's to happen. And so the trust didn't need to continue. The test under the statute is continuation needed to achieve a material purpose? There was no material purpose left that existed after the passing of Phyllis to be achieved through continuation of the trust. And that's why the trust is subject to approval under the trust code.
If I may, I'm sorry to hold you over here. If the court were to determine a material purpose or a primary purpose was actually the mechanism by which to distribute the corpus, how would that impact your argument? In other words, take care of Phyllis's needs in her lifetime may be incidental to maintaining or growing the corpus, which at some point is distributed as the object of the trust.
Right. I don't think that in of itself is a material purpose. Just providing for successive beneficiaries, if you look at the restatement of trust, that in and of itself is not a material purpose. There has to be something else. And here are the material purpose of this trust was to provide for Phyllis, and the marital trust said she had the power and the authority to withdraw that portion of the trust, which in reality is what happened here through the settlement agreement. The amount that was to be distributed to Phyllis through the settlement agreement was 26.3%. And that amount was an amount that was consistent with what a prior attorney had decided should have been the trust share in the marital trust. So it was, this agreement was really just achieving what should have been done and wasn't.
And did you have a question? Just me with the record real quick. Was a fully executed written settlement agreement submitted to the trial court in this matter?
It was not, because Phyllis passed away. And so at that point, the Paul Mendick family then refused to go forward with the settlement. So they didn't memorialize the agreement in the settlement documents. But as we've outlined in our brief, that is not the end all be all. The agreement between the attorneys, that the emails that were exchanged, is a valid agreement, and the court has the authority to approve that agreement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Covey, good morning to you.
May proceed. Thank you very much. May it please the court, my name is Chris Covey, and I represent counsel. I represent the appellees in this matter, and in the interest of time, I will not list them individually, but I too will refer to them as the Paul Mendick family. I won't spend any time on this, on the facts, but I would like to walk through a little bit of the procedural history, because we find ourselves in a strange place from where we started. This started as a petition for instruction by the trustee. During the pendency of that, the parties began negotiating a settlement. At which point, in the middle of those negotiations, while a draft, the first draft had been exchanged, the ward passed. So the settlement agreement sought to be enforced. Our first motion was to dismiss that or overrule that motion based simply on the fact that the power of attorney under which Nancy Jo Hyda was purporting to enter into this agreement didn't provide the authority for her to enter into an agreement from which she would ultimately benefit. And so that was our first issue we raised, and we had a hearing on that. And in Judge Harmon's June 25th order, he essentially held, I agree, under Cisneros, a previous case from this court, you can't enter into this agreement because ultimately Nancy Jo Hyda would benefit, because the money that was being pulled out of the trust that was intended for the Mendick family was now going into Phyllis's estate, which would benefit the Hydas. And so the judge said, that's self-dealing. But in raising it on his own sua sponte, the judge said, but maybe there was a waiver here. So never pled, never argued, never asserted. But Judge Harmon said, I'm going to hold this thing over for a trial on whether there was waiver. So we prepared our case. We went in front of the judge, assuming, I thought at least, that it was going to be a very distinct argument on whether we waived it. Well, there was no facts to support waiver. They didn't argue waiver. They, in fact, conceded that point. But Judge Harmon, after a full evidentiary hearing, changed course. And so in his ruling, he said, I'm not going to get to whether there was an agreement, whether it was sufficient between these emails or the power of attorney. Instead, he said, I'm going to jump to the end and assume you'd brought me a valid agreement. Then I'm going to make the call on whether this is something I would have approved of. And so the analysis in his opinion, the one that we're here on today, is had this come to me as a legal agreement, what would I have done with it? And he concludes, I wouldn't have enforced it. I wouldn't have allowed you to modify and terminate this trust because it's not consistent with a material purpose of the trust. And there's several reasons to support that. I mean, first and most importantly, the ward had passed. Your Honor asked if we look at it at the time of approval or entry. I think at the time, even the agreement that they say is enforceable has the language subject to court approval. So nothing is final until the court says yes. And the court is not going to ignore the current circumstances and go back in time and look and see whether there was at the time a material purpose. Here, very clearly, this trust was set up to do one thing. It was a safety net that Richard Mendick put in place. He wanted this money to go to his family, but as long as Phyllis was alive, this was a safety net for her. That's why there's language in there that says that the money is to be distributed to her liberally, considering other sources of income. Well, we didn't find out until trial that Phyllis Mendick was a very savvy investor. Phyllis Mendick had a $3 million trust, which was more than enough money to pay for her $13,000 at Hillcrest, assuming just a 4% return. So the only motivation for this entire matter is to get this money out of the trust where it would have gone to the Mendicks, where Richard Mendick wanted it to go, and get it into the estate. And that became even more clear after Phyllis passed. So on those grounds alone, this court can uphold the county court ruling. Now, there is an interesting issue here between whether this is a modification or a termination. Now, at the end of the day, the statute requires the court to determine whether it's consistent with a material purpose. But here, it's both. The agreement contemplated a termination, but it also contemplated a very big lump sum payment to Phyllis Mendick, which is not a term, which is a modification. There's no basis in the trust for that distribution because it has to be for her care, considering the other sources of income. So it was a modification and a termination. So the court was not in error there.
What would have happened to the Maryland Trust had it been funded at the time of Phyllis's death?
Had it been funded at the time of, well, you mean Richard's death?
No. Is it Phyllis's wife?
Phyllis is the wife, but
right.
But
so the Maryland Trust is funded at Richard's death, and at Phyllis's death, there's money still in that Maryland Trust. What happens to it?
The money in the Maryland Trust would also flow to the beneficiaries. Now, along the way, had the trust been administered under the terms of the trust, income would have automatically been paid to Phyllis during that time. But, and again, we're getting outside the record to get into what happened 10 years ago in this case. And you know, this was, attorneys looked at the marital trust and ultimately it was never funded. So as Justice Miller-Lerman pointed out, that's a non-issue here today. There was no marital trust and that's not what they're seeking to enforce. There's no affirmative allegation.
Well, what we're trying to do is fund the marital trust before Phyllis passes away. That's the intent of Phyllis in bringing this action. She's asking the trustee to pay in money to the marital trust. Is that correct? And the trustee asked for instruction whether they should pay a lump sum into this marital trust.
Well, mechanically, that's a little incorrect. That's the ultimate goal. That's what they wanted to have happen. But they weren't. The marital trust was never to be funded. What they want the court to do, based on a series of emails, was just write a check from the trust for 26.3%. The correct address.
Initially, didn't they ask the trustee to pay money to Phyllis during her lifetime to offset her monthly expenses at Hillcrest?
They wanted additional. Yeah, they wanted additional sums paid.
They were giving $1,000, then they gave $3,000,
yes.
And it was more than that to pay for her care. So they wanted, yes, money through the marital trust to fund her expenses.
Well, not the marital trust. The marital trust never happened. I mean, it's on paper only. So they just wanted more money out of this trust. And that's when U.S. Bank said, well, we need to know what other sources of income you have. and they wouldn't provide it. Again, I think we're outside the actual record and the transcript here, but that's what happened. And then the marital trust comes into play in the discussions of settlement about, okay, had this been funded, where would this money have been? But even then, there wouldn't have been a distribution straight out of a
lump sum. My question initially, at her death, that money would not have been paid out to Phyllis, would have gone back to...
I'm 90% sure that's accurate. I don't have that language in front of me, but again, the marital trust was such an ancillary issue to once we got in here that I don't have that section memorized. And then alternatively, and I think the record is clear, and I think the court can affirm Judge Harmon based on his written opinion, but alternatively, there is this issue of the power of attorney. There's this other grounds on which the court can affirm this. And under 30-4024, the power of attorney statute requires a specific writing in the power of attorney, a specific bequest of power, if the POA, if the holder of that power of attorney is going to do anything to personally benefit, and that person is not a first level family member, there has to be a special line in that power of attorney. It doesn't exist. As the record shows, during the initial settlement meeting, my partner Tom Kelly handed a copy of the statute to their attorneys and said, "This is a concern of mine. Can I have the power of attorney?" And they said, "I'll get back to you on that." It wasn't until a discovery request that we got the power of attorney. They wouldn't give it to us. And so at that point, that's when this whole issue came to light. And we thought, well, they never even had the authority to start down this path. And we didn't know that because they wouldn't tell us. So on those grounds.
If I may, you're suggesting several paths, I think, in response to the appellant's argument. Is that right? And you have moved on, if I'm correct, to the proposition that the power of attorney did not give this POA the authority to do this proposed settlement. Is that correct? Because of
yes,
a conflict and a failure, I beg your pardon, and a failure to be explicit in giving the POA this opportunity.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I stopped the defense of Judge Harmon's written opinion, and I've moved on now to an alternate ground. If the court were to find that Judge Harmon was in error in some fashion, this is an alternate ground to affirm his opinion. And then finally, just because it bears mentioning, because I'm involved in another matter now where some of these cases, Beatty and some other ones, are being cited, this series of emails, if the court were to hold that Harmon was wrong in his opinion and also that the power of attorney somehow authorized her to do this, then the court's going to be faced with, is this series of email an enforceable agreement? And if this court were to rule that that's an enforceable agreement, it's going to chill and change the way lawyers talk to each other and settle it. Because this was a series of emails that said, we agree to the number, send us a settlement agreement. They sent a settlement agreement over that was completely unacceptable. And who knows what would have happened after that. If the counsel that are engaged in these discussions, texts or phone calls, don't know where gotcha is, don't know where the line is to cross, I'm not sure how we go forward in settlement. We'll have disclaimers, I suppose, we could add to every email that says, until my client's wet signature is on a piece of paper, nothing is binding. And I think that the cases they've cited are distinguishable, but should the court get that far, we would ask for some guidance on that because it's a slippery slope that I'm starting to see crop up in some other parts of my practice. I have nothing further, so if there are no further questions from the court, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Very good, counsel. Thank you for appearing today. The court will go on to the next case of the day. And you are excused. That's fine. Appreciate it.